Sally Potter, who is the director and writer of Orlando, a movie that is now being released. Sally, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
I wanted to first of all ask you, this is a very elaborate first question, but I just feel compelled to ask it. One interesting aspect about Orlando, from my standpoint, is the fact that it's almost a textual collage. You don't really use a lot of the prose that's in Virginia Woolf's book. And if you do use it, you often modify one word or two words. There's Spenser's The Fairy Queen, there's Joseph Addison's The Tattler, there's Shelley's I Arise from Dreams of Thee. It's basically, if you're a literate person, there's a smorgasbord of collage and possibilities. And I'm curious why you made this particular decision. Was the idea here to reinforce some of the sexism of the literary world that Virginia Woolf's true prose would not be represented in the film version of her work, or what happened here?
Well, I think the essence of her prose is the skeleton of the film.
Yeah.
And I tried to make a distillation of what she'd done to further distill her own project of distillation. She writes in her diaries about wanting to exteriorize consciousness, writing in images rather than language, and where usually she was working with a kind of inner monologue, the stream of consciousness project, through the word. In this case, she was working through a description of images that were like watching the inner mind unfold, but not just one individual's mind, a kind of collective mind. Now, she was also working with a tapestry of references.
Yes.
So the book is littered with one reference after another.
Yeah.
And when you, again, go back to her diaries and look in her essays, which I did, and go back to her sources, you see that she was doing a kind of postmodern collage herself.
Yes.
So all I tried to do was stay true to that principle, but make it work in cinematic terms. Anything else would have been a disservice to her as a writer.
But in terms of using the other, mostly, in fact, all male writers that you used, instead of the specific quotes often, like with the exception of, for example, the trial and the poetry scene with Green, I'm curious how you made that selective process. Did some reference in the book cause you to grab for the Norton Anthology, or what happened there? And also, I was curious, in terms of changing one specific word of a passage, did you encourage the actors to paraphrase from the script, or did you actually have the original?
No, but I did so many drafts.
Yeah.
You know, my first draft, in fact, when I took it to my script editor at Faber and Faber, he picked it up, weighed it, and said, go away and take out 100 pages. You know, it was really long, the first adaptation. So it was clear, you know, there had to be cuts. And some words work spoken and some words work written.
Yeah.
And so through the very long development process and multiple redrafts until reading it aloud to me and so on, first of all, I learned about the importance of things actually working rather than working in theory as you intended them, and to try and be very open to listening and observing what worked and make things fit so that they had, a natural feeling for the voice and body of that particular actor who's manifesting the idea.
Yeah.
And so that entails changing things from time to time. But for example, you know, Nick Green's satiric poem about Orlando and Orlando's bad poetry are not in the book. I had to write them.
I figured as much.
From clues.
Yeah.
So I had to, in a way, fill in certain gaps that, had she written them on the page, would have had a different status.
Yeah.
And also from her, you know, she does a sort of sketch of 18th century authors, and you know who she's referring to.
Yeah.
And again, I had to fill them with actual quotations. My guiding principle always was stay true to the spirit and the intention, but not to the letter of the book.
Yeah. But in terms of, like, for example, Green's scathing, ridiculing response of Orlando's poem, I mean, I'm wondering if you lifted or sampled from any particular language to get that particular...
I tried to imagine myself into Nick Green, the character's shoes, and write iambically a satiric verse about the patron.
Similarly, I always wanted to ask you about the particular smiles that Tilda has throughout the film, particularly when she's a man. She's shy when she's called the casualty of love. Near the beginning, when she's in the Elizabethan court, she's a little bit smug. And then by the end of the film, her smiles are actually more natural. They're actually more realistic. And I'm curious how you developed this with Tilda.
Over several years, you know, we smile at each other a lot. We still do. And I think the feeling of complicity, of intimacy with the viewer started with our own intimacy in the working process. You know, me watching her, her looking back at me, how do I respond to her look, and so on. And I wrote initially long speeches that would be an equivalent of Virginia Woolf's addresses to the, you know, dear reader. You know, she was always reaching out from the page, across the page, into the mind of the reader, having a conversation, in effect. So I wrote quite long speeches initially that got whittled down and down and down and down, and many of them ended up eventually just as a look.
Yeah.
But that look came as a consequence of a long process of relationship, which in effect I tried to kind of transfer into the lens. That's what we did.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
that you could have a feeling of the depth, that sort of depth of friendship in a way with Orlando, and knowledge that would take it away from being a spectacle that you were observing, you know, a bonnet picture with lots of lovely stuff in it, and into a relationship with an essential human.
Yeah. Well, she does have a relationship with the audience by constantly addressing them. And I'm curious if you had attempted some early draft where you were trying to get that biographical tone that's in the book. I mean, at what point did you essentially figure, oh, this narration or the constant asides won't work quite as well in film? Or was, for example, Orlando addressing the audience kind of your answer to Virginia Woolf's parenthetical asides?
Yes, that.
Yeah.
But also a history of, you know, performance. Performing is not literature, but in the history of performing, the roots of cinema, of course, are back in the theatre and painting. But in the and painting, of course, in portraiture, you know, where does the eye, where the gaze is, where the eyes look, is always important.
Yes.
And in the theatre, the fourth wall, you know, the addresses and soliloquies and monologues and so on across to the audience is you know, a huge, huge part of, going back to the Greeks, part of that tradition. So although it seems in a way, when you first, it's sort of shockingly modern when you see it, its roots are very, very ancient.
Well, I also wanted to ask about the use of Othello. One of the problems of reading the book is the fact that they have the whole Moorish head thing, which is not exactly good by today's standards.
No way.
Is this your workaround for this, to honor the spirit of that while also, you know, basically having her dress terrific play like that?
Well, you know, Virginia Woolf, like all the Bloomsbury group, had certain blind spots.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
there was anti-Semitism, there was racism, there was kind of exoticism about the Middle East and so on. It would have been a... It had she lived until 1992, I think she would have revised many of these things. And I felt, again, it was a disservice to her and to the book and to the greater project of the book to collude in a way with some of those thoughtless images.
Yeah. Did you ever make any efforts to attempt to toast cheese in an Italian fireplace? Because that seems to me a really I mean, it's a bizarre image in the book, and I'm wondering if it was even possible to translate that into film.
Not necessarily. I mean, again, in the earliest drafts, you know, when I kept everything in, more or less, it became clear that the everythingness that is in the book, it was not appropriate to the similar a similar feeling of extraordinary inclusiveness on film. You have to distill the plot line, take events out, but saturate the image.
Sure.
So there's enormous detail in each image, and that's the equivalent of many, many pages of prose. That you don't have to see. So it was an attempt to eliminate the redundant, which, again, she talks about in her diaries as being what her project was.
You've clearly read Woolf's essays, and I wanted to actually ask if you had read her essay on the cinema, and whether there's... I'll quote one line from it. She writes, "Something abstract, something which moves with controlled and conscious art, something which calls for the very slightest help from words or music to make itself intelligible, yet justly uses them subserviently, of such movements and abstractions, the film may in time to come be composed." Was that a guiding principle for Orlando, or even for your other work?
Well, you know, it's amazing when I hear these quotes. I must have read it and then forgotten it. And when I went back to look at some of these original quotes from her diaries when I knew I was coming here and the film was being re-released, and discovered how many of them had become guiding principles that I had forgotten.
Yeah.
And, you know, you kind of absorb them. I'd forgotten that one. Of course, it's interesting to think about in 1928 what cinema in its relative infancy was suggesting it could become.
Yeah.
And already was to some degree in Russia, for example.
Sure.
So she was much more of a kind of hard-headed modernist, I think, than people give her credence for. Mm-hmm. You know, that she's often treated as somehow locked into the Bloomsbury group with its preoccupations and its sort of florally bohemian, apolitical in a way sense, whereas somebody like James Joyce was, you know, pure literary genius. And I think people don't take the core of her work seriously enough. She called this, people called the book light and frivolous, and she knew that she wanted to be light about things that were intensely serious.
Yeah. I also wanted to ask about, I have to, the crinoline dresses. The thing about the scene where she walks through the shrubbery and where she walks also through her estate, mm-hmm. with all these white sheets of furniture, it's just exaggerated enough where you could conceivably buy it. And I'm curious as to how long it took to get that specific width. When she sits down on the settee, you can just buy it, but it's just expressionistic enough for us to accept it. And I'm curious how you calibrated that with your costumes.
Well, I think that balance of suspended disbelief, if you like, was a question across the board.
Yeah.
For the design, for the clothes, for the sets, for the performances, for the language, for the titles, you know, for everything. And I think it was about trying to make credible and absolutely believable a world that, which once you start to pull it apart and analyze it, is completely impossible.
Yeah.
That is, you know, that experience of exaggeration actually is an emotional experience for the great mysteries that are often underplayed. You know, why do we only live 3 score years and 10, more or less, give or take, decade 2 or 3? Why are we born one gender or another, the accidents of birth, of class, and so on. These are the great imponderables that are beyond exaggeration, and the lives that most people live secretly, mm. and in their hearts, the dramas and the crises that people live through are much, much more exaggerated than the width of any crinoline ever could be. So I feel that on the whole, realist cinema does not echo the extremity of lives. Mm-hmm. As we live them and feel them.
Yeah.
So I wanted to make images that more mirror our inner sense of how we live, what we are, and even the objects around us.
Well, there's a certain irony in that statement. You think that hard realism simply cannot encapsulate this feeling to live, to at least feel that sensation through the screen or through a narrative, require some kind of phantasmagorical element or some experimentalism?
No, look, I love some realist cinema. I think of Bicycle Thieves or something that. But in fact, that's not really realistic. All cinema is artifice, you know, documentaries included, perhaps even the most of all. But I think that when you feel that you've got to somehow represent the world as it appears to be, you're missing the point.
Yeah.
Because we all know things aren't the way they appear to be.
Yeah.
And it's the dynamic, it's the tension between the experience of things we can almost hardly bear to face, mm-hmm. and the apparent look of how things are. We know there's an enormous gap.
Yeah.
And it's exploring the gap that is so exciting.
It's more about viewing it from a contextual angle, by something like a wide crinoline dress.
Well, in a film, you try, and especially with a film like Orlando, we all had to spend enormous amounts of attention on the visible world, the details, the textures, the lights, the colours, and so on. I mean, literally years of preparation when I go back and look in my files, in order to render them unimportant. Mm-hmm. In order to render the invisible thread of life that goes through and transcends the material world, somehow make it seeable. But to do that, you concentrate on what's in front of you. You know, the exact width of the dress, its exact colour, its exact placement in the frame, you know, how the light falls on a face, and, you know, and so on. You look at what's there in order to look at what's not there.
So exactitude that may not actually be tangible within our reality is how you solve this question.
Well, that is the stuff of cinema.
Yeah.
It's ephemeral. It's absolutely ephemeral. It exists through time. You can't pin it down. You can look at one frame, but essentially it's an experience.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to also ask about the sheets over the furniture I had alluded to earlier, and the sheets in the latter part of the movie when they're all outside.
The Christo moment.
Yes, exactly. Part of me thought, well, maybe this is probably by design, but another part of me thought, well, I wonder if there's any insurance concerns with the estate that you were shooting in that kind of motivated the artistic decision. What of this?
No, because I had mapped the film in terms of color palettes, mm-hmm. you know, the Golden Age and at the beginning, the Elizabethan period through the Victorian period of purples and greens and so on. That moment was a sort of, in a way, a monochromatic yeah. moment. And so this was all part of the transition between palettes, and I'm sure there also would have been, as there constantly were, simple pragmatic solutions to complexity. Yeah. I mean, most realism includes too much information. The way it was designed was by taking things out. So eliminating anything blue in one particular shot, yeah. or, for example, in that long scene where everything was coloured in drapes, there are about a million colours in that space. Yeah. No, I wanted this, a white dress and everything white, and this sense of the clean sheet, the blank canvas, the beginning of something,
yeah.
and so on. And I'm sure, you know, there may have been an insurance thing. I mean, the pragmatic issues become just part of the engine of invention always.
Did you consider to have the great freeze over that was yellow in the book and it's blue in your film? I'm wondering why you.
What was yellow?
The fissures in the ice flows in Orlando, the book.
Yeah.
They're often described as yellow. The sky is often described as yellow, and yellow is probably the biggest color in the book. And so I'm wondering, in relation to how you design your color palettes, how colors from the book.
Well, the word yellow on the page has got a very different significance, and I think I felt that we had gone through the Golden Age. I probably pushed it a little bit further on the film, so we'd gone through this period where there were enormous amounts of gold and flames and all that in the earlier section, and the next section was cold. You know, it had to be cold and blue, and to me, the colour of chill is blue. It's not yellow.
Yeah. I wanted to also ask about your tendency to shoot scenes often where the camera is almost trying to capture in a humongous canvas but can't quite get it. So you'll tilt to the left, you'll tilt to the right. It's in the very beginning with the oak tree scene. It's also during the scene with the Turkish prince. I'm curious how that developed, if the idea that there was a world beyond the frame was one of the intents behind this particular camera usage.
Well, it was partly a style of shooting, if I can call it a style, of no coverage.
Yeah.
And not using the conventional, so-called conventional language of film, you know, shot, reverse shot, and so on, but rather a feeling of movement through imagery. So in a situation where mostly people would shoot two ways, look one way, then look the other way, the camera moves between the two. So you have a feeling of connectedness, a feeling of flow, a kind of rhythm, almost a hypnotic sort of swinging of a pendulum back and forth and back and forth. That became part of the rhythm of the film, but also about the business of the frame and what's in the frame, there was an attempt to be throwaway.
Mm-hmm.
So you design this massive situation. Let's take Uzbekistan, the scenes shot in Central Asia, in the book or in Constantinople. We found all the twins we could find in Uzbekistan. There are 500 sets of twins in the background, and there is not a single shot that pans past them and says, hey, look, we found all these twins. You find them if you look.
Yeah.
But it's throwaway.
Yeah.
And that kind of sort of shock, I wanted to create almost like a shock of, there are treasures, but we're not bothering to look at them.
Yeah.
Because it's not what's important.
Sort of similar to the textual collage I had mentioned before.
Yeah.
I mean, how many people are really going to... I got so curious. I was like...
It doesn't matter. It means, first of all, you can go back several times and watch a different film each time if you want. But secondly, it's saying all the time, it's this arrow through time. It's the person. It's looking always at what's important, or following a thread that's important, not attaching over importance to the less, you know, the less important things that are in the frame. They're there.
Yeah.
They're present, and they're there if you want to look at them. But we're going to keep our gaze on this arrow through time.
But for the swinging pendulum shots, surely some production logistics of shooting a master shot in, you know, in saving time instead of doing a whole bunch of shots.
It doesn't save time.
Huh.
No, that was my decision because the shoot was incredibly short.
Yeah.
You know, it was 10 weeks on three continents.
Yeah.
With travel included.
Yeah.
And with, you know, 400 years, change of sex, blah, 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 blah. So therefore, I had to decide to make a commitment in a way to no multi-options, you know. Mm-hmm. No, in the cutting room, we could cut it this way, we could cut it that way, let's do a master, let's do a close, let's do a medium. There wasn't the time for those kind of setups. It was deciding this is going to be the way the film will appear.
Yeah.
This is how it will cut together. This scene will be seen entirely through one camera move. This caused enormous nervous tension on the set because it meant that sometimes, you know, half a day would go by preparing for this one shot, which, however, once we got it, was the whole scene.
Yeah.
But, you know, you really had to keep your nerve.
Well, I think I'll end there, but thanks so much, Sally. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you. She might have slipped the lid. I pops the crack, I snaps you in the head, taps you in the neck, kicks you in the teeth, steel toe caps, takes all your credit cards, get up, get the guns, get the eggs, get the flat in the face, the flat in the face, the flat in the face. Dance, you fucker, don't you dare, don't you dare, don't you flat.